Healthcare Committee Subcommittee on Health Policy to order and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2650. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back. Day two on 2650. What we're going to do here... Oh, I'm sorry. We also have our colleagues from education here today.
We do. House Education Committee on Education. I'd like to call a public hearing to order, and I would like to relinquish the gavel and all of the executive duties to my colleague.
Thank you, Representative.
There are two members of the Education Committee here, at least.
This is true. Representative Greenlick wears both hats. So. He wears many hats. This is true. So the plan is we are going to spend 1 hour today to continue testimony on 2650. We have other bills we need to hear at 4 o'clock. We have a list from Tuesday that we're going to start with and hope to get through that by 4 o'clock. I'm going to ask people to be as brief as possible so everyone gets a chance at the mic. We're going to start off with Sharon Morgan and Cindy Hyatt. And I appreciate those of you who are back today. I know it's often a challenge to schedule to come down here two times in a week. So thank you for coming back. And you may go in any order. Just state your name for the record when you start.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Morgan. I have been a registered dietitian for over 25 years and currently work as a food service director in the school. I have experience in one-on-one counseling, consulting, and managing multiple types of food service operations. I'm also the mother of two young women who struggle with their weight. I am opposed to the passage of House Bill 2650. I also have a statement from Tony Silvernagle from North Saniel School District and a statement from Carol McLeod from Newburgh School District. Thanks. One thing I've learned in working in food service, if people are hungry, they don't learn as well and they don't listen as well, hence we brought some snacks. We don't need research to teach us that. I care deeply about the obesity that plagues this country and the food machine that fuels it at all levels. I want to make an effective difference.
These aren't $10 in any of them.
These aren't what?
$10.
They're not $10 in any of them.
No.
Good.
Don't take eight of them.
Take as many as you like.
For the record, there are carrots and cheese.
Carrots and cheese.
Thank you.
Sure. I want to make an effective difference in stemming the tide of obesity with our youth. I believe this can be done, and it can be done through education, exercise, and nutrition. Nutrition changes are most long-lasting, in my experience, if they make sense to people, and people have to buy into those changes. In our schools, as with most people, nutrition changes come by adapting portion size, frequency of offering, and providing variety. This provides the opportunity for real change versus artificial manipulation of standards. After listening to Tuesday's testimony, I would have to say I have a better understanding of ONPA's stand on the benefit of limiting vending machine and school store options, in part because these components of the school deal mostly with packaged items. It makes sense to put the work on the vendors to change their product mix that they would sell to our schools. I believe the bill has been presented such that it does not affect the NSLP or school food service program. I believe there needs to be a clarification today to better understand how this bill actually would impact school food service departments statewide. I like practical examples of food because that's where we live in school food service. So I'm going to try and make the point that there's two ways that I see school food service departments is working. One is in the reimbursable world. Here's my very high-tech sense of that. And can you put that one over there? And one is in the a la carte world. And that's what I'm trying to differentiate today to you. That's fine, yeah. I'm just going to put this up for now. Well, let's go
for the record and for the recording that we have various types of foods being lined up.
Okay. Most, can everyone see these? Enough. We'll get to the specifics. Most school districts provide two types of food service, if you will. One is a reimbursable meal, right in front of me here, which falls under strict USDA guidelines. This part of the school's food service program would not be affected by House Bill 2650. This has been accurately portrayed on Tuesday. Second part of the food service program is the a la carte program, which is items over here in front of Cindy. These actual foods may be prepackaged, but such as, say, this, but many of them are made on premises in our kitchens by our staff. These freshly made foods do not come with any nutritional labeling at all. The attachment that you have in front of you, entitled Items Sold a la Carte That Are Not Packaged, lists a host of items that are currently being made at Tiger Tualatin schools that do not come prepackaged, that are sold under this category of a la carte foods. And you can see there's over 100 items there. The list exemplifies that not all a la carte items are bad foods. We're not talking, I'll just call it that, bad foods, whatever you think of as those. These are foods which we take issue with in these strict parameters, which would cause us to drop many healthy and popular items with no real foreseen benefit. In rebuttal to Christy Obing's comment that close to 98% of her foods could fall within the guidelines of House Bill 2650 without creating undue hardship, this would not be an accurate statement for any food service department that sells a la carte items, such as these. Portland Public, as I understand it, does not sell this. They sell only these. Any school food service program would suffer a fiscal blow if this bill passes as written. Public record indicates in excess of a $900,000 loss when the a la carte sales were removed from Portland Public Schools Food Service Department last year. The same type of fiscal impact would affect all existing districts selling a la carte items. In my district, I barely break even every year and have the second smallest free and reduced number of students in my state. My margins are extremely small. When this bill is applied to specific foods sold a la carte at the lunch counter, not the reimbursable meal, the resulting list of foods we cannot sell to students is confusing, even to me, a registered dietitian. I took the bill and began to analyze current foods that I sell. The bill has such products as these juices, which I buy through my co-op, 84 districts in the states, 4-ounce juice. I cannot sell this under this bill because it does not contain 10% or more of the recommended daily value of 3 or more vitamins and minerals. I can't sell it. It's all juice. I could sell this one, 10-ounce juice. It does have the correct amount of daily vitamin percentages for 3 or more vitamins and minerals. But I don't understand, and what I would tell a student, why I can't sell them the smaller item instead of the larger item and how that would curb obesity. How does this help with the issue? Another example of this confusion comes when a student in an elementary school comes to me. They brought a brown bag lunch or they've purchased a lunch and they want to buy a juice from me because they're thirsty. Maybe they have a milk intolerance. Maybe they're allergic to milk. They want a juice. I would have to say to that student, I'm sorry, I can't sell you a juice. And they would say, why? I don't know what I would tell them. If a child in an elementary school came, say, and bought the reimbursable meal, and in that meal they chose to have a juice, and they said, I want to purchase a separate juice from you, I would have under this bill to have to tell them, I can't sell you the second juice, even though I included it under USDA guidelines because it would fly. I don't understand this in this bill, how that would help curb obesity. Unbreaded chicken tenders, chicken witches on whole grain bread, and yogurt parfaits like the one sitting up here, none of these would fly under this bill. It does allow items like Godfather's pepperoni pizza, which sometimes gets a bad hit, like Pop does and donuts. This would fly under this bill, and there is an attachment also in your packet that has foods, which may not, major entrees that we've listed that fail, and major entrees that are okay under this bill, based on the 450 calories and the 4 grams of fat per 100 calories. Another example is this is a hamburger, and a hamburger with a beef patty and a whole wheat bun does not fly under this bill. It doesn't meet the parameters as stated by the entrees. So if a child in my high school comes up, buys the reimbursable meal, gives me their $2.75, they say, you know, I'm hungry today. I love hamburgers. I want to buy a second one. Would you please sell me one? I would have to say no. What sense does this make? I don't know. The bill also states that snacks may not have any trans fats. And last weekend I was reading in the USA Today, the trans fats occur naturally in foods such as milk, butter, cheese, and beef, in small amounts perhaps, but nonetheless. Does this mean we cannot sell any snack items that contain milk, cheese, or beef? But it makes no mention in the bill of trans fats not being allowed in the entrees. So my entree, I imagine, could have trans fats, but my snacks cannot. I would propose that when nutritional standards are set forth with the goal of curbing obesity, one must first evaluate these standards against real foods on the counters in schools. If the standards are written in such a way that they exclude foods which we all know are healthy, then we should reevaluate these standards. One of the most popular foods that I sell this year in my school is this yogurt parfait. I would not no longer be able to sell this food because it exceeds the limits that are stated in here. Another food that we came up with...
Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes, Representative.
I just want to clarify what you're talking about. Is you have a problem with having standards, or do you have a problem with some of the specific standards that are in the bill?
Good question. I have problems with the specific standards as they apply to these a la carte items off the counter. I don't think they teach the child anything on the other side of the counter. And I think that is part of our goal as food service directors and educators.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your... I know you may not be finished, but okay. Before we go on, why doesn't the yogurt parfait meet? Is it the calories? Is it the fat? What is it about that?
Good
it looks
question.
Really good. It does.
Yeah, what are you doing with it later?
Eat your carrot.
As I understand this bill, it says that any entree we would sell could not exceed 450 calories. There are several parameters, and if you look on, I think it's the second to last sheet that you have in my packet. The parameters are 450 calories. It must not exceed. It must not exceed 4 grams of fat per 100 calories, which is the next to the last column. And quickly scanning down here. This exceeds it, I believe, on the grams of fat per calorie. I'm trying to quickly find it on here. It has too much fat. It's very popular at my schools. And it's one of those kinds of items kids are asking for because they like to walk away with foods. And it's not, it suits vegetarians, which is hard to find oftentimes. And it's great. And it's got mangoes and strawberries in it and calcium.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to get too off track, but just out of curiosity, is it made with low-fat granola and
low-fat yogurt and low-fat granola?
Yes. Is that more than 40% calories in fat?
It has more than 4 grams of fat per 100 calories.
That's 36% calories in fat.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned something that I was curious about, and it's funny that the yogurt parfait triggered this for me. That's something that we would often get for our daughter for out someplace because she's a vegetarian. And I'm wondering in the reimbursable meals, are there adequate choices for vegetarians? And would there be the ability in the a la carte meal for a child that wasn't having protein through meat to be able to purchase a la carte items like a parfait or something that has a lot of cheese in it that would provide them with that necessary protein if they weren't eating meat?
Under this bill?
Under this bill. So I guess I'm wondering about a la carte. Are there appropriate choices under the reimbursable meal? My daughter says there aren't. Can vegetarians buy their lunch for the reimbursable meal? Would there always be choices, or do they rely on the a la carte in order to buy lunch at school if they're vegetarian?
So for vegetarians in school, are there currently choices, and would there be under this bill for both reimbursable entrees and a la carte entrees?
I guess my as you raise this, my concern is, uh-huh. Could a vegetarian student, if this bill passed, would they be able to get adequate nutrition off of an a la carte menu? And if not, I'm just going from personal experience that in the reimbursable meal, there really aren't a lot of vegetarian choices for.
My best sense is that what I'm trying to point out about the way this is written with the specific standards, not that there are any standards, but there should be no standards, is it would make it difficult. Maybe a more pertinent example is here's another thing we make for vegetarians or for anybody, and we call it grab and go. It either has fresh apples or purple grapes. It has a couple cracker packages, and we sell it with two cheese. As I understand this bill, I could not sell this with the two cheese because it exceeds the grams of fat per 100 calories. If I took a cheese out and left it with 1 ounce, I am under the traditional plan of school feeding, and I have to have 2 ounces or more of protein, so I couldn't sell it with one. So I'm kind of messed up here. So I think it would limit some of our choices based on the same issue here that 4 grams per 100 calories might trip us up because some of the vegetarian entrees or egg or so might exceed because of fat in those kinds of entree choices what these restrictions are stating. It's hard to give you a broader sense without knowing a specific entree. I just think it would hem us in a way that we don't want to be hemmed in to find those different good-tasting food options for kids. Here's another one maybe to answer you. This is today. This I don't know what you think. I think this looks pretty good. Maybe you'd like this after with your yogurt parfait. It's a cheese sandwich, whole wheat bread. We make this now. We try and make it look yummy with lettuce and tomato. Right now, this would be out. Once again, it has too much fat, too many grams of fat, 4 grams exceeding per 100 calories.
Ms. Morgan, that brings up a point. And I'm going to ask that we also move along quickly because I want to make sure your colleague, co-testifier, gets a chance to testify. But that brings up an important point for me. We can't look at a food and know if it's healthy. And I'm wondering if you have do you have standards in your school to how do you determine what is nutritious in the food that you serve? And do you think that scientifically that the standards in this bill are somehow incorrect in terms of portion size, calorie size, fat size, you know, amount of fat? I mean, there are lots of things that don't qualify because they have too much fat in them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering what kind of standards you set for the, you know, you're very knowledgeable about what you're serving. What are your standards?
Those are two good questions. I think the first question, as I'm understanding it, is what standards do I go by now in what I do every day when I get up and go to work? I think the USDA guidelines are fairly reasonable standards, and the fact that I'm hemmed in by some price points is another good standard in a sense. So I'm always looking for what I can sell in my reimbursable meal and what qualifies under government standards and by my knowledge as a dietitian. And what qualifies under this umbrella of standards I think should be able to apply to what we sell a la carte. If this hamburger is good enough to give a child, a student, under the reimbursable meal, why should it not be good enough to sell them solo?
Could I do a comment?
Yes.
And the second
question was, scientifically, do you think the standards in the bill are just...
I think the standards are wonderful, as I was trying to say in the beginning, for vending machines and for school stores and such like that. I think the basic construct that we deal with under USDA guidelines for the school lunch program are probably basically ample because there's more and more standards coming out. I know that are going to become more and more strict, and if we get too many layers of standards, state standards, new USDA standards, I think it's confusing. Plus, in the meantime, we're going to wipe out a tremendous amount of options that kids like, are healthy, and I don't know how to answer a student when they ask me, why can't I have it? So I think it's appropriate in this certain venue. I think it is not appropriate on this side of the table, a la carte, under the food service program in a school.
Thank you, Representative Dahl.
Yes, I think, but I do want to underline so that as we move on. One, I heard you say, or Lean, that you said that the standards as written would be okay for a vending machine, in your professional opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And then you did the USDA standards. How often do they change? Has the USDA standards taken into account the epidemic in obesity? Are you seeing that in the standards?
I'm not as knowledgeable as some food service directors in terms of what's coming up. What I do know is that USDA is reevaluating their standards, and I'm understanding, I think as Janet Beard mentioned Tuesday, that there's some parameters that are coming out in December or January to speak to this. I do know that, like, for example, the sodium is being considered to be in the 700 milligram range for the whole meal. So what I'm hearing is, yes, they're going to be changing probably in the next 12 months to some extent, and I've got to assume that's to accommodate to obesity epidemic.
Thank you very much. And then just a comment. As a school teacher and superintendent, I often heard that the dog ate the homework, but this is the first time the legislature has ever eaten the testimony.
Well, it's hard to interpret this data in numbers unless you match it up to food, and that is what we do in schools, and that is hopefully a point I've made today.
Representative Gelser and then Representative Green. And then I'm going to ask us to move on to Ms. Hyatt.
Thank you. I was just skimming back through the bill trying to trigger what it had said about the fats and calories, and I'm looking in Section 1, sub 2 A, which is talking about the calories from fat, and it says this requirement does not apply to snack items that are legumes, nuts, nut butter, seeds, eggs, non-fried vegetables, and cheese, and they may not have more than 10% of total calories from saturated fats. This requirement does not apply to snack items that are nuts, eggs, and cheese. Would that help with some of those items by excluding the cheeses and the...
Well, it depends if it's a snack item or an entree. As defined, I don't know. When I read this, it would be helpful for me to know, is this item under this bill considered a snack, or is it considered an entree?
If I may interject there, that's an excellent question. In fact, we're going to have the proponents come back up and answer that question, because that did come up.
We truly don't know this.
And we've asked them to come back and answer that, so I'm going to hold on that particular entree versus snack issue. Representative Greenlight?
Thank you. Do you know if the USDA standards has a maximum percent calories from fat, total fat?
Mm-hmm.
What's the maximum?
33%, but they're looking at 30%. They're looking at going up because trends have gone from low fat to additional fat, because we've seen actually some problems with people who are experiencing a deficiency in fat. And so it's based on the dietary guidelines for Americans.
Ms. Hyatt, could you state your name?
Yes, and I'm sorry.
That's quite right.
Should...
Yeah, I think you were almost done, so if that's all right, we can move on to Ms. Hyatt. Yeah. Thank you so much.
May I follow on that?
Soon as she says who she is for the record, then you can follow.
Chair Kotek and members of the committee, I'm Cindy Hyatt Henry. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
But what I thought you said was USDA standards were okay because you had to live with them anyhow, and you wouldn't object to them if there was the same standards for snack foods. If the requirement in the USDA is 30% calories from fat, and maybe it'll go up to 35, why should 35% calories from fat be a problem for you in the snack food?
Are you understand?
4 grams per 100 is 36% calories from fat, right?
What I was trying to say, I think, was that I think that the House Bill 2650, as written, would be adequate and appropriate for vending machines and school stores, et cetera.
Yeah, I follow?
Yes.
I thought I heard you say that if it was okay for the USDA, you wanted it to be okay for the a la carte. If the maximum of the USDA meal is 30% calories from fat, why would 35% calories from fat?
Oh, because that's on a meal basis. That's a meal. And I think it's not appropriate and helpful or teachable to take each particular item and say, you can't have more than 35% per item. I'll give you a good example. My student at my school goes through and they get an entree, they get an apple, a carrot, and let's say they get a milk, so we all feel better about their bones. Most of the fat in that meal, and I'll tell you it won't be over 35%, comes from the...
No.
Entree.
The hamburger.
So this is the heavyweight with the fat. If we're going to make a rule that says all our reimbursable meals, no particular item can have more than whatever you want to say, 30% or 35% fat, I might have to take out all my entrees. This is a gross exaggeration. And then we'll be left with all low-fat foods. The point of dietary guidelines, and I think somewhat USDA, is a mixed meal. It's in a day's intake for human beings. And that's how we should judge it, not on each particular item, because then you can't have this. Then you can't have this. Then you can't have this. You can't have this, but you can have this. Does this make sense?
Hold that thought. Representative Kahl?
Comment that I'd like to make, and I too am a school administrator outside of the wonderful hall grounds that we serve on. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, I really appreciate people coming forward, because when a bill is being discussed, it is a dialogue that we can all learn by. And the only other comment that I would make is, coming from a family of 14 children and being a school administrator for 15 years and seeing all kinds of kids, our children are extremely resilient, and they are flexible. They bend to the leadership of the adults in our schools. I come from a district where we have a high proportion of our students are Old Believer Russians. I assure you that this isn't a concern of theirs at all, because 6 weeks out of the year, they can't have anything with animal meat, milk, product, cheese, milk, nothing. And our dietitians, our cooks, they're not formal dietitians. I assure you, make sure that they are able to have the food that they need to have academic success. And so I would just remind all of us that this is about our children. And they will do whatever we set out for a standard for them. And I do appreciate the extra comments, but we do have a health concern.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Hyatt. and I know that you've handed us written testimony, and honestly, in the interest of time, highlight, that would be great. Thank you.
Chair Kotek and members of the committee, I'm Cindy Hyatt Henry, and I am the current president of the School Nutrition Association Administrators Chapter, and I'm the food service director at McMinnville School District. I've been in this industry for about 25 years since I graduated from college with my degree in dietetics. I also worked for a contract company, which is an interesting side. I've worked for self-operated school districts and school districts that employ contractors. I did that for about 18 years. I'd like to give you the perspective of a medium-sized school district and just say briefly that our district has about 6,300 students. We have a total of 10 schools. And our free and reduced averages are in the neighborhood of 48% district-wide. In comparison, Portland Public has similar numbers. But, for example, Lake Oswego has, I've been corrected, 7% free and reduced. And this is a factor to food service directors who are trying to break even every year, if nothing else, break even. And for the student who receives a free meal, each district gets $2.56 for that meal from the government. And for the student who receives a paid meal, they get whatever the board decides will be the going rate. And in my district, in the elementary level, it is $2.10. And so the point of reference here is to help you see that there's a gap between those two numbers, and that we need a la carte sales in our districts to supplement the costs. Last year, if a la carte sales were not allowed in McMinnville, or if they were hindered greatly, say, for example, we decided to do what Portland did, we would have lost $203,000 in revenue.
Ms. Hyatt-Henry, and I apologize for not getting your name correct the first time around.
Okay.
The bill doesn't say that you have to stop selling a la carte. That is Portland's
choice.
I just want to clarify. Okay.
Yes, and the reference here is that I'm also representing the other school districts of our administrators chapter who do sell a la carte as well. And that while Portland is okay with this bill, we aren't. And the people in that chapter who voted on the 27th at our last meeting to look at drafting another option for a bill, the people, the districts, the supervisors from the school districts were Bend, Centennial, Grants Pass, Salem, Tiger Tualatin, Lake Oswego, David Douglas, Hillsboro, Reynolds, North Marion, Woodburn, and McMinnville. And there were about 174 other food service directors or supervisors or head cooks who couldn't come to that meeting because lots of them are in small districts and they have to prepare the meal or be the business manager or be the secretary. And so there were a lot of other school districts at that meeting who were not represented. All this is to say that one size does not fit all and that our districts do need the option of selling a la carte and that this bill does impact that ability to do that. I believe it would be unfortunate to pass this bill when there is such a positive focus already in our society on this issue. We also need to look at physical activity, nutrition education, in addition to food standards. And our culture is finally tuned in. However, this bill is just a Band-Aid, in my opinion, on the wound, and it will not heal the body. I do not want the public to believe that this is a good answer to a systemic social and physical epidemic. In the testimony on Tuesday, the representative from California stated that the School Board Association, School Food Service Association, and the public health organization from that state all agreed as stakeholders in the passage of their bill. We aren't there yet. And despite multiple efforts on our part and the part of the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance group, we aren't there yet. We welcome discussion from them and continue to welcome it, as they have welcomed ours. Our next meeting agenda for our administrator chapter includes a representative from the Clinton Foundation to discuss this very issue. I will pledge the efforts of the administrator's chapter and our group to continue to dialogue, to reach consensus as long as it takes, but we are not there yet. We all want change for the better for our children and society. And I believe that we need to give our state the same opportunity for consensus that California had.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. I'd like to call up Mary Lou Henrich and Nancy Becker, proponents of House Bill 2650. I'd like to see if we could answer some of the questions. We will not be moving this bill out today, but I think it would be helpful at this point to get some clarification on some of the questions that have been raised. And then we have, these are who I have signed up to testify, and it would be helpful if I knew they were actually here.
Yella McAllister, Chris Cahill, Kevin Grove I saw, Hillary Wells, Carrie Brooks, Edward McGlone, and Patty's not here.
Okay, great, thank you. We could keep it brief,
yes.
And if you can address any of the discussions about potential amendments of what you've heard or clarifications that you think would be helpful.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek. My name is Mary Lou Henrich, and I am here representing the Oregon Nutritional Policy Alliance. Thank you for asking us back. When we heard concerns, I guess we're going to try to address the concerns we heard last time and then some more of the same ones from today. And what I'm going to talk about a little bit is the stuff from the State School Board Association, the local control issue. And then Nancy is going to talk more about the specifics of the bill related to dietetic standards since she's a professor of nutrition. And then I'll come back with just a couple things on the end about it, basic principles that we tried to apply and things that we did feel we've tried to compromise in getting a good bill before you. So first thing is that childhood obesity, we've heard, is a statewide epidemic, and the steps to prevent it are one of the most important public health policy issues facing the state right now. That's why it's in your committee, Chair Kotek. We can't wait any longer. One of the things I heard today is that we aren't there yet. One of our concerns is how long can we wait? I actually have presentations that I made in March of 2003, and then again all between now and then with a lot of these groups. And the children who were freshmen in high school when I started making those remarks in 2003 are graduating. And we can't go back and capture those 4 years that we've lost. So we're concerned about that. Even though things may not be perfect, we need to move forward, and we certainly are willing to figure out how to do that in the best possible way. Local school districts have had more than 2 years to develop and pass robust policies for foods that and beverages sold outside the national school lunch. And I gave you a table. We won't go through it today, but it does give you a rundown of those 174 districts that did turn in policies out of about 189 that should have turned them in, and then that only 20% of them had anything specific in it about what we're talking about here. They said a lot of generalities, and you can kind of see, and I'd be glad to answer any questions, but I'm not going to take time now. We also recognize, and we can resonate with the value of local control, but we think that Representative Gelser did such an eloquent job of explaining, as a school board representative, I mean, she was on a school board, how there are some times when we need statewide consistent standards, and we believe that that time is now for this issue. So now I'm going to turn it over to Nancy Becker to talk more specifically about some of the concerns that you've been hearing about a la carte, school lunch, the standards, and how do they apply and how would they apply.
And if I could just interject, thank you. There are two things I want to make sure we get to.
Yes.
Definition of entree and snack.
Okay.
And the issue that was raised yesterday by Representative Bonamici about the different age ranges.
Yes.
And whether or not we should adjust that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. So about the entrees, let's just get that. California has defined an entree versus a snack.
For the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Nancy Becker, registered dietitian, chair of the School Food Working Group of the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance. So an entree means a food that is generally regarded as being the primary food in a meal and shall include but not be limited to sandwiches, burritos, pasta, and pizza. That's in the California statute. And a snack means a food that is generally regarded as supplementing a meal, including but not limited to chips, crackers, onion rings, nachos, french fries, donuts, cookies, pastries, cinnamon rolls, and candy.
And that's in the California bill. Would
yes.
You would be amenable to adding that to the
absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, if that helps with clarification, that would be just fine.
Okay.
So I just wanted to say a couple of things about what I heard my colleague Sharon Morgan say about our standards. First of all, I'd like to reiterate that these standards are not numbers pulled out of a hat. They are standards that were set by a large consensus panel convened in 1999, as Amanda Purcell told you, that looked at what would be reasonable standards for snack foods and a la carte items in the school food setting. So we didn't just pick these numbers out of a hat. Something like 10 states have already enacted legislation such as this that use essentially the same standards. So these, we didn't just make them up. I also want to address this whole notion of you can look at a food and decide for yourself if it's healthy. That, quite frankly, that doesn't make any sense to me. How can you look at a food and determine whether it's healthy? That's a very subjective notion. And what does healthy mean? And what's healthy to Mary Lou might not be healthy to me. Certainly, if a child is confronted with a couple of foods and is supposed to say which one's the healthier, what does that mean? It has no meaning. To combat obesity, you have to think about calories in and calories out. So the only way to decide if a food is an appropriate serving size is by the calories. Okay, so if that sandwich is too many calories, serve the kids half the sandwich. Okay? And as for the fat, in the unitized meal, in a lunch in the unitized meal, you saw the burger and the milk and the apple and the, what was it, carrots? I couldn't see from over back there. The fat in the hamburger is sort of diluted by the other foods that are in that meal. So the fat, the hamburger is, let's say, 40% fat, but in a whole meal, it's down to about 30% fat. So we're talking in a la carte about snacks. It's not a unitized lunch. It's not lunch. It's a snack. It is meant to be a part of or be an extra of a lunch, or it's seconds. Okay? So it is totally reasonable to have a fat limit on snacks as a percentage of calories. It's totally reasonable. And quite frankly, if there's a list of foods that that one can have, that you can calculate the, and it's not a difficult calculation by any means, the number of calories and the percent of fat, yes, you're going to find some foods that will fit and some foods that won't fit. That's the whole purpose of this bill, is to determine which foods are too high in fat and are too concentrated in calories. That's the whole purpose of the bill. If it was true that all of these a la carte items already met the standard, we wouldn't need a bill. Okay? That pizza may or may not fit the standard. Just by looking at it, how do you know? You can't know. That's nonsense to decide what's healthy by what it looks like. Nobody can do that. We can't do that. You can't do it, and certainly children can't do it. When we're providing food to children, we decide what's the appropriate serving size, and that's the role, in my opinion, of food service in an institution, a publicly funded institution, is to make that decision for the child, not to be at the whim of either the food industry that makes bigger and bigger packages, or just the fact that somebody seems to like to put a couple extra ounces of cheese on a sandwich. That's not making decisions based upon nutrition. That's based upon making decisions about what the market will bear, what kids will buy. That's how we got into this problem.
Okay. I'm going
to... Oh, you're going to stop me because I'm getting out of hand.
And that's so, okay. I appreciate calories. I really do need to move on to the other folks who are signed to testify because we need to move on around 4 o'clock.
Can I answer your question?
Which one?
About the what we would do about the different ages,
yes.
The different schools.
Yes.
Okay. Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici asked the question, what would we do? And we would be very willing to say that if it was a K to 8, that we would use the higher calorie standards, that it's like the 180 versus the 150 that would be in a K to 5, because we have the middle school going up to 180 calories. And then if it were a middle-high school combination, to go up to the higher, the 200. And there may even be in Oregon some small districts out in rural Oregon that have everyone in the same building, and there we would allow the 200 calories because it's the older children who are really buying more of these things, and I bet you they have a hallway. But let's just make it easy. That's the
and
point.
And I can just say that the National School Lunch Program is also having to make similar adjustments because of these blended schools. So it's not a unique decision. In other words, there's precedent for doing that.
If you give me 1 minute.
No, actually,
no.
Okay. Sorry. I've got Representative Flores, Gelser, and Brune, but if you're seeking clarifying questions on the bill, that's what we're trying to get at this point. So, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is a point of clarification because you just gave us information that this applies to snacks, and that does, mm-hmm. excuse me, Representative, you're not playing footsie there.
Quite all right. Yeah, no problem.
And that would not be me. The following apply to all foods sold at school during the time described: a snack item sold only in single serving size with the other criteria, total mm-hmm. fat, etc., and b, small b, page 1, line 22, on an entree item that is sold individually. So in the example that we did see here, the yogurt parfait would not be eligible or qualify under the standards that you have set out, which I think is a reasonable alternative for, as examples were given, as someone who likes yogurt and granola and mango fruit and mm-hmm. berries and is, on top of that, might even be vegetarian. So they couldn't have that advantage because it is an entree item sold separately, theoretically.
You know, it's too high in fat. It's too high in fat. But you have to look at the numbers. You have to look at the numbers. And maybe it could be reformulated using a lower fat granola. Mm-hmm. it would work then.
Or a smaller portion size?
Yes. Or, well, the fat, you'd still have to worry about the percentage of fat. But, yeah, find a lower-fat granola. Granola's a high-fat food. Lots of times
okay,
there's coconut
to be clear
in it, which is even, you know, saturated.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Gelser?
My question was on the same line with that yogurt parfait. The issue, I'm still unclear on the issue of a snack versus an entree. If I looked at those pieces that were there, I would see a yogurt parfait for some children really to be that entree, to be that main thing that they had. And I believe that there are, I understand the idea that the a la carte is extra, it's the second, but I think that in practice for many children, they create their lunch mm-hmm. by putting together the a la carte because it better fits their taste, it may better fit their dietary needs. Would you be comfortable with the definition of entree and snack that didn't preclude items that are on an a la carte menu from being considered entrees?
Representative Kotek, Representative Gelser. I think that actually the entree designation makes it a little easier. Actually, the standards are easier. You don't have to talk about sugar. There's, you know, so it's efforts, and I think this is what California told us, was that they worked very hard to go to the max as far as they felt was healthy for their children. And so whether you call that a snack or an entree, and a yogurt parfait on those two lists, I'm not sure. But let's go with it. You're seeing it as an entree. Actually, the calorie limits that California and the school food service people down there agreed on was 400 calories. We've said 450 because we had talks with the school food service people here, and they said there were a lot of things that were 422, 428. We said, let's go 450. The fat percentages are the same as the California ones. They're the same as in New Mexico. They're the same as in Connecticut. They're the same as in Kentucky. I can't understand why children in Oregon are so different than children in those states, and why food service is so different that they can't work with us to make this happen. Instead of arguing about the bill, I wish we could be working on how do we help them implement it? How do we give technical assistance? How do we find the lower fat granola, the ingredients that we can make a lower fat yogurt come in?
And clarification. I appreciate that information, and I'm less concerned at this point about whether or not the parfait is bad or good or how much fat or how many calories. I didn't hear in the definition of that entree or snack. If you would be comfortable with a definition of entree that would allow items that are sold a la carte to be considered entrees rather than anything that's a la carte is simply a snack, because kids do build their lunches out of a la carte.
Representative Kotek and
Gelser,
that's what we do it. I think they do by having a slice of pizza on a la carte that meets the guidelines. That's an entree. That's how you get to decide the pizza, for example, or the parfait, if you want. And I think there's probably going to be some of these that we maybe have to decide if it's the yogurt, is that an entree? But then it just has to meet, if it's considered an entree, it just has to meet the 450 calories and the fat.
So in other words, if I may just say, if you counted that parfait as a snack, it would be harder for it mm-hmm. to meet the guidelines. As an entree, it's a looser. All it would have to do is get some lower fat granola, and it would be a terrific. Just have to lower the fat in it, and it would be fine. If you started defining it differently, then it gets then that's when you get into the complications, because the snacks are more complicated than the entree. It's a looser definition for entree.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gelser asked my primary question, but Nancy, I want to ask you just real quickly, as a defender of the great all-American sandwich. Okay, how difficult is it within the guidelines within this bill to do that, to build a sandwich that would fit the guidelines? And I mean, we can talk about all the lunch items.
Yeah, I don't think it's difficult at all, unless you load it up with mayonnaise.
Right.
You know, it's just
and within
not
the bill,
difficult at all.
Madam Chair, I know a lot of food services take the mayonnaise out as a high pack. It's in a little, you know, mm-hmm. aluminum container. Would that be part of this, or would that be a separate item? Would it even be included in this?
That's not included.
Okay. Thank you.
That's not
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be very brief, in part because I can hardly talk and have no business on the health care committee when I'm sick. I think Representative Gelser's question and your response just kind of calls out for the need for some definitions, but I'd also like you to address briefly, because I know we're in a hurry, the issue of food that is actually made by the school. And we had testimony on Tuesday and more testimony today about all the different things that the kitchens make. So how do we address that? Do they have to calculate every single time they make something, in which case I can see them getting a very limited list that's been calculated and then only offering those options? And then also with regard to the snack, entree, a la carte issue and the definitional issue, I'm just trying to figure out, as the child goes through the lunch line, who's going to be the entree snack police to make sure that they're only getting one of whatever and what they can have and can't have?
Well, lunch lines are organized. A child goes through the National School Lunch Program lunch line, and then there's the a la carte is someplace else. It's different. They're paid differently. They're required to take certain things. And these are very different in different schools, but my understanding is that that's the way it's supposed to be, that if a child is eating a unitized lunch, they have to go through that part of the lunch line, not the a la carte. So it's a physical separation, because if you're buying the National School Lunch, you're not supposed to be getting any of that stuff anyway.
And your other question?
The other question is about calculating.
Right,
and calculating. I would love to address that. We're talking about calculating two numbers, the calories in a food and the percent fat. It's really not that hard. And my understanding is there may be some foods that are made by hand or from scratch in kitchens, but it's not the majority of foods in most schools. Most of them come from a package. But even if you had to calculate it from scratch, it's just not that complicated. There's a book called Food Values of Portions Commonly Used that you can go in and, you know, look up. If you can read the box scores, the sports box scores, you can do the calculations, the food, you go across to the calories, you go across to the fat, you multiply by 9, you divide by the calories. It's really easy. And I did it just last night. It took about a minute and calculated a burrito using a tortilla, 2/5 of a cup of beans, and an ounce of cheddar cheese. I came out with 327 calories, 32% fat. It's just not hard. And also, once you've done it, you've done it. So the next time you sell the burrito, you've already done the calculation.
And I'm just curious. We don't have any, what's the word? No one's going to come and check if they somehow are off by a calorie or two.
No.
I mean, you know.
No.
But it's the best case. Yeah. There's no calorie cops in this. Okay.
The calorie police.
Oh, I want to move on to the folks who signed up.
Yeah.
You will be back, for sure.
We will.
But thank you for your time. I'd like to call up Galen McAllister, Chris Cattell, and Kevin Grove. And I'd like Mr. Grove to go first.
Wait,
do
you have age?
No, he has a dog on his T-shirt. Sorry. No. Yes. And then I'd also, after that, I'd like to see Mr. Edward McClone, because I know you need to leave. So. In fact, Chris, would you mind sitting back in just a second and letting this other gentleman go? Because
sure.
He needs to leave at 4
yeah,
o'clock.
No problem.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate that. So, Edward, thank you. So, Kevin, you're up.
Okay, my name is Kevin Grove, and I'm a senior at Benson High School in Portland. I'm on the site council at Benson, captain of the tennis team, member of the wrestling team, and a national merit scholar. I'm going to be going to the University of Colorado Boulder this fall. Today I'm here to talk about the foods at school. At Benson, until the start of this year, it was really easy to get junk food at school. It was everywhere. Essentially, we could fill up on candy and soda because it was right there. And because we don't have PE anymore, there are no ways to burn it off during school. For wrestling this year, I had to lose weight. I had lost enough to drop 2 weight classes. I stopped drinking soda, and I stopped with junk food in order to lose 36 pounds. It was much easier to do without soda and junk food being in my face all day at school. After listening to the testimonies on Tuesday about how hard it would be to implement these new standards, I have to commend Christy Obink and her staff for what they've been able to accomplish in Portland Public Schools. At first, it was a bit annoying to not be able to get heaps of French fries, but really, it's not too hard to acclimate. So all of us, kids and adults, are bombarded throughout the day with companies trying to sell us their products, and at least at school, we shouldn't have to deal with it. I play a lot of sports, but I have a tendency to gain weight, have fluctuations there, and this makes it a lot easier to help maintain, which I have since the season. Because we don't think about what we eat, kids will eat whatever is near them, and this way, at least if we want to indulge, the options are much healthier.
Thank you, Kevin. Questions for Kevin?
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming back on Tuesday. Edward.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Edward McLone. I serve as a legislative aide for Representative Tobias Reed of House District 27. As well, I'm a member of the Beaverton High School class of 2007. At Beaverton High, I have witnessed firsthand the eating habits of high school students. From what I have seen, students do not make healthy choices when provided the opportunity at school. I have as well given into the temptation of sugary junk foods, including cookies, chips, and brownies. Among the items that have been presented to you, are notably absent. If you enter the crowded, loud Beaverton cafeteria, you immediately will notice the food that students are eating, and you may expect to see students eating sandwiches, fruit, salads, etc. Unfortunately, you're in for a rude awakening. While our school does provide healthier options, including chicken burgers and Caesar salad, students regularly choose the a la carte options, including brownies, chips, and sugary juice drinks and slushies. The school cafeteria itself is not the only option that students can purchase junk foods. In fact, our student store, The Pond, is located in the cafeteria, offering such items as Noah's Bagels, which, if any of you have taken Weight Watchers, rate an 8 on the point scale, which is essentially, for an average weight person, is one-third of your daily daily intake. Along with that, you could get some cream cheese to put on there, a Sobe, Monster, an energy drink, or other forms of high-calorie fat food, all of that for less than the cost of a regular school meal at $2.90. The way the current system is designed, students are encouraged to purchase the unhealthy food. Quite simply, it's convenient. If a student is late for a class and they have lunch very late in the day, they can just run into the cafeteria using what can be simply described as a debit system for a cafeteria. Students punch in their personal identification number and are able to go ahead and purchase any kind of food they want. Much to the parents, unbeknownst to the parents, students are purchasing any kind of food on their parents' own bill. Parents simply write a check, the student deposits it, and then uses that PIN number to access any form of food. Yes, some do choose the healthy foods. However, quite frequently you will see students skipping regular meals and going for the junk food which you have not seen. Brownies, numerous types of cookies, chips, popcorn, and other form of junk food are rampant in our school. Healthy foods are not so. This unhealthy food and lack of exercise is leading to a growing level of obesity. Certainly, you are all aware of the alarming statistics regarding the number of obese children in America and in Oregon. The front line for addressing these issues should be in our school cafeterias. In health class, students watch the movie Fast Food Nation and learn how to calculate the nutritional value of their food. They also are required to monitor their caloric intake and exercise daily for a week. However, how are students supposed to practice the skills they learn in an environment where they are bombarded with nothing but unhealthy food and unhealthy learning habits? Our schools send clearly a mixed message in the classroom. We learn that junk food is bad and exercise is important. However, the cafeteria provides unhealthy food, and exercise opportunities are rarely provided unless students enroll in overcrowded health and PE classes. School should be a place for students to practice the skills they have learned, which, as I have said, cannot be done in school environments. I am sure you will hear testimony from those who represent school districts telling you about their concerns for lost revenue from soda machines, vending machines, and other lucrative contracts. The Oregon School Boards Association reported that in the 2002-2003 school year, cafeteria food sales raised over $130 million, excluding junk food sales from vending machines and soda bottles. I appreciate the concerns of those costs and the losses that this legislation may cause. I have walked the mosh pit of the hallways in Beaverton High School, and I can understand and appreciate what this loss of possible funds may do. However, when our school are considering lines, they should not just look to the bottom line. They must also look to the waistline of their students. You have had nutritionists come and testify before you, and I have witnessed this, and show you what you can get and what you cannot get. You can get pizza, and you can't get yogurt. But again, you have not seen the other side. You have not seen the juice, the sugary drinks, you have not seen the energy drinks, you have not seen the brownies, nor the cookies, nor the popcorn, nor the chips, nor the slushies, nor the fruit by the foot that is offered in our school. The list goes on, and you do not see what else is on that list. And what is on that list is what the students actually get. I urge you to seriously consider the health of our students when you decide this bill. Students will eat what the school provides them, and by voting in favor of House Bill 2650, you will be voting for the future health of our students, and will provide them with the healthy foods that they need so they can grow to be healthy young people and eventually become adults who are the future and are the healthy future. Thank you.
Thank you, Edward. And thank you, Kevin. It's nice to hear from the students. I'm going to move on to, I believe, a parent.
A parent.
Good afternoon. My name is Galen McAllister, and I have three children currently in the Salem-Kaiser schools. I'm a Salem chapter chair for Stanford Children. I pass along remarks. I will not go over them because I think you've heard many of those points. I just wanted to explain how I became involved in this at the Salem level. We at the elementary school were seeing nachos served to kids as part of the USDA lunch program. We were seeing corn dogs, nachos, pizza on the same day, same choice menu, and we were very concerned. And we went to our food service people, and they said, well, what can we do? We're trying to compete with all the other foods kids are offered, and so we just want to make something that they can eat. And we went to the high schools and the middle schools, and we saw kids eating Skittles and Mountain Dew for lunch, having a triple mocha cappuccino for breakfast. So we said, gosh, we have to do something. At the same time, the opportunity came along to be involved at the local level on crafting our local wellness committee. And I have to tell you, we have 375 Stanford Children local members in Salem, and we had dentists, pediatricians, oncologists, school nurses, and teachers involved in the effort to craft a school wellness program. It still took us about 18 months, about eight long board meetings to get a policy in place. And most districts don't have that. The benefit of those resources. We were surprised. We had all these, you know, testimony from experts in the field, nutritionists, doctors, dentists, telling us what should be in a reasonable wellness policy. And the district staff kept bringing us this really bland one that didn't have any meaning to it. And we kept saying, where did that come from? All of our public testimony has been saying strong policy, strong policy. All the public statements by board members, strong policy. And we found out that the bland policy that the staff kept bringing back to us was the one that they downloaded from the OSBA site. So to me, when they talk about local control, that really wasn't local control. That was trying to make it easier for districts to do nothing. So I have to tell you that in schools 5 minutes from Salem, they have really weak policies or no policy at all, and kids are still eating the triple mocha cappuccino, still having French fries as, whether it's a snack or an entree, their lunch. And we're seeing really poor nutrition outcomes and really poor nourishment outcomes, which aren't as visible as obesity, but are as important to student achievement. So one other point I wanted to make is that Salem-Kaiser School District passed a wellness policy with rules that are very similar to the ones we're discussing today on August 8th of 2006 and implemented them by September 9th, the first day of school of 2006. So they were doable. It was reasonable. We made it across the board, including food services, because our students and our teachers and our parents were saying, why, if we're going to make standards for the stuff in the vending machine, why wouldn't we have standards for the stuff on the a la carte line? And it just seemed fair and just to us to make it across the board, and it seems to be working. The students haven't rioted. The schools aren't going out of business. And I think there's a lot of respect from students that, hey, you're finally selling us what you keep telling us we should be eating. So, thank you.
Thank you. It's great for you to be here. Questions? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I kind of want to ask the questions of Ms. McAllister, since you're the parent here, although the two students should feel free to chime in, too, if that's okay, Madam Chair. The comment was made about, for example, in Portland, that there's no PE in the schools. I would certainly hope that when the PE bill comes up that requires schools to have it again, that y'all will show up to testify in favor of it. But do you think that that is a factor as to the amount of exercise that our kids get, or is it just because they see what we as parents do, which is, you know, get home from work, sit on the couch, eat potato chips, and go to bed?
Well, obviously, it's a combination of a lot of factors, and we can't be paralyzed by the fact that there's a lot of work we need to do. We need to do the easiest things first. This seems to me a no-brainer, and I'm almost exasperated by the fact that we have to argue about it. My children are not obese. They're extremely active and very athletic, but I still worry about the food choices that they're seeing every day and that they would get into a habit where, you know, as a high schooler, you might be able to live off of Skittles and Mountain Dew and French fries and not gain weight because you're playing soccer and you're active. But when you turn 25 and you're not so active anymore, you might suddenly gain weight. So these are habits we're putting in place in school and when they're young that could do a lifetime of damage to them. And I sort of feel foolish as the nutrition person here because obviously I have work to do, but I'm trying not to instill those bad habits I learned as a child in my children, and that's why I'd like some support from the schools to do that too.
Kevin or Edward, would you like to comment on the PE or the...
Well, I'm generally a three-sport athlete. Now I'm down to just two, but I've always had problems with my weight. And while at home, my mom's got a master's in public health. We don't have anything unhealthy there. It's still very, very easy to take what's easy, what's cool, things like that. So this, at least what Portland has gotten so far, has helped a lot. And it would be great if we had PE. I haven't had PE since freshman year. So.
Let's work on that.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Crummell, the Beaverton High School requires students achieve 2 credits of PE, which essentially means 1 full year of taking PE classes. However, all PE classes are essentially maxed out by the beginning of first semester with at least 40 students in every one. So my experience says that if you provide them, the students will take them.
Thank you. Representative Dalla? And then I'm going to move on to the next panel.
You talked about in your school, Salem Kaiser, that you have implemented basically the same package. You talked about the impact on the front side of the program. Do you have any information, or could you get us any information on the back side of the program? Has there been weight loss? Has there anything that would make this program worth it? Because we are going to step in on local control. We are going to tell people what they can and can't eat. I would like to know that something's going to come of it. Can you help us with that?
In Salem Kaiser, it's only been since September, and so there's been no scientific study or anything. I know in studies across the country where these where schools have been doing these things for many years, it's a simple calculation. You lower the amount of calories and fat, you're going to lower the weight gain. But we don't. Salem Kaiser's only been in effect since August. So.
The reason I worry is, having been in the school and in the cafeteria, and as a superintendent, you look in the garbage can, not in the kid's mouth. Are we throwing it away or are we eating it? And when kids would come through the line, and you have a 205-pound senior, if he wants more spaghetti, he gets more spaghetti or whatever. Probably maybe a bad choice. But where I'm going with this, though, is we're going to reduce the size of the portions. Are we going to see, with data, some appreciable results? Because to head off on this trail, any results that I could see, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Less calories in, more weight off. But that may make sense, but may not be what is happening. And I really want some data
Sure we could pull you some national data. UC Berkeley's done some really good studies. And actually they found the healthiest schools or the healthiest outcome for children only have food service. They don't have any vending or any a la carte services. But there's been studies done of different schools and what the outcomes are depending on the regulations. And I would tell you, we sort of have the study in reverse from the last 20 years when we've been serving all this stuff that we would call junk food, and we've seen the obesity increase. So we've already seen the negative study. Now hopefully we'll see the positive study.
I don't want to put that data load on you, but I will be asking others that might be able to get it easy.
We can get that.
Thank you. We'll get some of that for the committee. Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful panel. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
The last folks I have, and I apologize for cutting, you will have about 2 minutes each because we need to move on to another bill. Chris, Dr. Wells, and Dr. Brooks. Am I missing anyone that was on the sign-up sheet? No. Yes, and we have two pieces of written testimony to make sure to note them for the record from the Multnomah County Democrats in support of 2650 and the Oregon Dental Association in support of House Bill 2650 and the YMCA of Columbia Willamette in support of House Bill 2650. Chris, you want to start off?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. My name is Chris Cable. I'm a program officer with the Northwest Health Foundation. Northwest Health Foundation was founded nearly 10 years ago with a mission to support, promote, and enhance the health of communities in Oregon and Southwest Washington. We achieve this mission by making grants to community-based organizations, by convening health experts and representatives of communities to learn about emerging health problems and potential solutions, and by providing workshops and education and technical assistance. For the first 9 years of our existence, we chose not to engage in the public policy process. We believed that supporting the work of our grantees was sufficient to achieve our mission. And while this proved to be largely a good strategy, we realized that the more vexing public health problems that our region faces require more than any one organization, any one grantee can do on their own. They require public policy solutions. And our nation's obesity epidemic is certainly one of those issues. That's why, for the first time in our foundation's history, we've chosen to take a position on pending legislation. House Bill 2650 would enact strong, evidence-based nutritional standards for all food sold in the school environment. Research has shown that children consume about 40% of their daily caloric intake in the school environment. And further, the health behaviors that they adopt during the school age are health behaviors that they're most likely to also adopt as they're adults. Schools represent an ideal opportunity to establish healthy behaviors that give every child an opportunity for a long, healthy, and rewarding life. Improving nutritional options for Oregon's school children has been cast as an economic issue, an educational issue, and a health issue, and it's certainly all of those things. But fundamentally, it's a moral issue. The Surgeon General has noted that unless we reverse current trends, this generation of American children will be the first in our history to have shorter lifespans than their parents. These shorter lifespans will be plagued by obesity-related health problems such as type 2 diabetes, heart disease, stroke, colorectal cancer, depression, osteoarthritis, and a host of others. The adults who can influence these children's lives have a moral obligation to ensure that this entirely preventable future does not occur. We must create environments in which the healthy choice is the easy choice for our children, and the first place to start is in our schools. Thank you for your leadership on this issue, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Chris, and I'm pleased to hear the foundation stepping out on public policy. That's great. Questions for Chris?
I do
Representative
have.
Cromwell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You referenced evidence-based nutritional standards. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what the evidence standards are and what evidence that the standards actually work?
Certainly. Well, it's my understanding that these standards, as written into House Bill 2650, were ones that were developed in partnership with the American Heart Association at the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, which also includes the Clinton Foundation, that they were reviewed and endorsed by Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And I'd like to think that, you know, if the CDC reviews and endorses a set of nutritional standards, that they know what they're doing. And so we take them at their word on that.
Well, I appreciate that, Madam Chair, but what's the evidence that the standards actually work? What's the evidence that says that, for example, a fruit drink that has no more than 120 calories per 8 ounces and contains 10% or more of the recommended daily value sold in a size of not greater than 12 ounces is that, what's the evidence that tells me that that standard is going to work so that our kids are going to get healthier?
You bring up a good question, because obesity as an issue is one that has so many different confounding factors and influences that teasing out one specific intervention in one specific environment is unlikely to be done anytime soon. These are new standards in terms of being implemented. It's going to take years to thoughtfully evaluate their impact. And we also have to look at other influences such as the built environment, agriculture policies, and outside of the school environment, as well as the home environment, to really get a handle on this problem. That said, that's not an excuse for us to sit back and not do anything. I think we, as I mentioned, we have a moral obligation to make the healthiest choice, the easiest choice for our children. So this is where children adopt their behavior that they're going to take with them for the rest of their lives. And unless we want a nation that's plagued with obesity-related chronic disease, we have to get a handle on the issue now.
I appreciate that very much, Madam Chair. But the thing is evidence-based has become a real buzzword in government and in medicine and in a lot of other areas. And what is happening here is that we're tossing it around. I never got my question answered.
Well, and I appreciate
and
that. I'm wondering if we should get some of those studies.
That would be one of the things that, you know, in the future, if we're going to toss around the idea of evidence-based and that sort of thing, then be ready to produce the evidence.
Well, and I think we could show some studies on what other schools are doing. We're
right.
Get those
yeah, I'd be happy to submit some peer-reviewed journal articles as a follow-up to this testimony.
That would be helpful. Thank you. We're going to move on. Dr. Brooks?
Thank you very much, esteemed chairs and committee members. I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to give testimony today in support of HB 2650. My name is Terry Brooks, and I'm a pediatrician from Eugene, Oregon. 2 years ago, I stopped clinical practice, and I've devoted my time to childhood obesity prevention advocacy issues. Last year, I was on the Eugene School District's School Wellness Development Committee, and this year I'm on the School District Advisory Committee. I'm also a steering committee member for a childhood obesity prevention coalition called the LINK Coalition for Healthy Active Youth, and it's called LCHA for short. And last year I started a school wellness committee at my son's middle school. Because of the time constraints and all of the wonderful comments I've heard earlier today, I've slashed my commentary, and I apologize if it's a little bit more disjointed, but I feel I'm here today more in the capacity as an advocate for children and the work that we've been doing locally. And I specifically would like to address the issue of local control, setting standards at the local level versus at the state level. The federally mandated school wellness policy law gave our coalition the opportunity to educate the public and offer assistance to our county school districts as they went through the process of crafting their own policies. Our coalition provided assistance to our county's schools in the following ways. The first thing we did is we spent many months, and this was a group of health providers, community leaders, and educators in our coalition that came together and compiled a toolkit to use for developing school wellness policy. And this was in the hands of all the superintendents in Lane County in fall of 2005. And this is really a very comprehensive document that really addresses a lot of the concerns raised today. This information was actually followed up. It was sent to every superintendent, and it was followed up by a personal call from two of our LCHA members, who are school board members from two different districts in our county. It was then followed up by giving presentations of this at regional school board and superintendent meetings. Additionally, we felt that we needed to do an assessment, and that was brought up today, of what's going on. So we did a pilot project, a BMI project, and that's in your written minutes. And this was all voluntary, but we had 56% of our school districts in Lane County participate in over 10,000 children. We looked at a pilot project of data of heights to weights, and it basically showed that mirrored what's happening at the national level, that 37% of our children are at risk for overweight or are frankly overweight. And as you know, we tend to use the word at risk for overweight to mean overweight, and overweight really is obese, but we tend to soften that for children. The third thing that we did was get involved in the local process by, I became a member of our own district's school wellness policy development, and I'm here to tell you that it took, as has been echoed today from the Salem Kaiser representative, that we spent hundreds of volunteer and paid staff hours before a school wellness policy with mention of competitive food standards was even mentioned. And we do have what I feel is I'm very proud of what we've done. And frankly, it was a revelation to me to see how many extra hours our school administrators and school board members devoted to our evening meetings, in addition to their full-time jobs and countless other subcommittee meeting responsibilities. I have the utmost respect and admiration for them. As a public health advocate, though, it was disheartening to learn that some children would be benefiting from a nutritionally healthier school environment while others do not. Only, as we heard from Ms. Henricks, only 20% even mentioned competitive food standards. So the efforts we made locally did not seem to have the effect we wanted. And it does not mean to disparage any school district. Not all schools had the personnel, time, or volunteer community involvement necessary to devote to an in-depth appraisal of the complexities of the school wellness issue.
I would like to respond to one comment that was made on Tuesday, and that's about teenagers and choice. Very quickly, as a pediatrician, I'd just like to share with you that the teenage years are really a time for experimentation and exercising new freedoms. And often health-related issues are often met with denial in teenage years. And yet, and we probably all remember that teenage years, it's hard for us to even comprehend that we would ever be 50 or even 40. But yet, some of us would argue that teenagers need to learn to make these food choices in school, the kind of choices that may irreversibly negatively affect their health in decades to come. We're not just talking about obesity. We're talking about osteoporosis. We all have seen the graphs, and this has not been mentioned all that I know since either Tuesday or today, that calcium intake, the 40% of total bone mass achieved in adolescence, and that's when they need calcium. And so this is a huge issue, and this has not been, I feel this needs to be addressed and is an additional issue that I'd like to mention. So I believe that the state of Oregon has a vested interest in ensuring that every public school child is able to purchase foods from an array of all healthful choices during the school day. Health promotion and prevention of chronic disease impacts every Oregon student equally. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I appreciate your consideration of what I feel is a very modest first step in improving the school food environment for this and future generations. And I feel that not only are we not taking local domain rights away from school board members, but I feel that with this bill, we're passing the baton to them. We're saying, this is the floor. And I'm stealing from Ms. Henrik, but she says what we're trying to do is build a castle of good nutrition. So we're asking that our local communities take this very modest proposal and build a castle on it of good nutrition. And it's one that's not going to be a la carte food. It's going to be one where students are embracing what a real meal used to be, which is vegetables, fruit, protein, and carbohydrates, and a source of calcium is liquid. And so I'm really proud of our district because they're excited when they look at the numbers and they have 10% increase, 15% increase in the hot meal program and less use of the a la carte. And so their emphasis really is on nutrition, and I hope that's embraced. Thank you,
Dr. Brooks, and thanks for all your advocacy in Lane County. And Dr. Wells.
Thank you.
I'm going to close this up today.
Okay, my name is Hillary Wells. I'm a pediatrician for Kaiser Permanente in Tualatin, and I come to you as a pediatrician on the front lines of trying to prevent and treat childhood obesity. Every day I see children from a variety of backgrounds, including children from McMinnville, Wilsonville, Tigard, and Woodburn. And I spend a large portion of my time every day counseling these children and their parents on making healthy eating habits and counseling them to be active. And specifically, the components that I discuss in my visits are limiting portion sizes, decreasing junk food, and sweetened beverage intake. We also discuss reading labels and making meals that are lower in calories and fat. And parents go home and take this information, and they're not trained in any nutrition science, yet they have no problems making lower-calorie meals to help their kids. We also discuss that it's important to eat a complete meal. So that means not eating a yogurt parfait for lunch as a only part of a lunch or just a hamburger for lunch. We talk about eating a complete meal. I do become dismayed, however, when I hear from patients and their parents that despite their efforts at home, they find it difficult to eat healthy in school, and we heard that from some of the students. And as a clinician, I feel my healthy eating messages are undermined at schools that serve large portions in the a la carte lines and junk food in the vending machines and student stores. And as a society, I feel like we need to be sending consistent messages to our children. Because childhood obesity is a public health concern. We cannot put making money ahead of children's health, and we do not have the time to wait. We will lose another generation to diabetes and heart disease before their time. I would like to talk a little bit about the evidence base. I'm sorry that Representative Crummell has left. I believe that Dr. Marks, in his information from Tuesday, included an article about the consumption of high-fructose corn syrup in beverages, and this includes some information about juice consumption. So I believe you have that in your packets. I only have one copy of it, but I will submit that as well.
I would also like to say that in the Healthy People 2010 report, which is published by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and I have included the reference in your information I gave you, this is published by the government and includes a lot of data from the U.S. Health and Human Services, and basically they listed overweight and obesity as a leading health indicator that reflects the major public health concerns in the U.S., and overweight and obesity were included as major health indicators along with physical activity and other indicators based on their ability to motivate action and as relevant as broad public health issues. And basically they state in their report that over time even a small decrease in calories eaten can prevent weight gain or facilitate weight loss. And they further emphasize the importance of choosing foods that are low in saturated fat and added sugars, and whatever the food, eating a sensible portion size. And that's where House Bill 2650 comes in.
Dr. Wells, I would ask if you could wrap it up. Thank you.
Okay, very good.
You're
Thank
being
you.
Very succinct.
I just wanted to say that Kaiser Permanente is behind this bill, as is Legacy Emanuel Children's Hospital and Oregon Pediatric Society.
Those are
Thank
formal
you.
Endorsements?
Formal endorsements, yes.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that. Thank you for that additional information that we can address some of Representative Crummell's comments. Thank you very much for your testimony, and I'm not going to take any questions because we need to move on to the other bill, but thank you for being here today, and thanks to everyone who's testified. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2650.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2650.
And I want to thank our education partners for being here, the Education Committee, so thank you for staying, Representative Ball. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2699. Take it easy. So we are waiting patiently for AV to get set up. We do have testimony on 2699.
Do you want me to start with the introduction while they're setting
up? Absolutely. Representative Gelser, would you like to introduce the bill?
Nope. Oh, no.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath in Benton County, House District 16. And I wanted to thank you for hearing another bill after an afternoon of interesting testimony. We are going to take a shift from healthy eating to gastrointestinal disorders. So House Bill 2699 is a bill that I've introduced on behalf of a constituent of mine that you're going to hear from in a few minutes. And he can tell you much better than I can about this issue and why it's important to him. But I wanted to describe to you why I brought this bill forward. As you all know, we have many people that ask us to introduce bills, and I haven't done a lot of them on behalf of constituents. But Mr. Barham came to me to share with me some information about this disorder and the way that it was impacting people in my district. And I was incredibly impressed, not just by his knowledge and passion for the issue, but also the commitment that he has demonstrated to trying to improve access to health care for people that are impacted by this and to improve research, committing significant personal, financial, and intellectual resources to the creation of a foundation, a research foundation for blastocystosis that has put together a number of publications, research studies, and also through his advocacy has led to a research study that's now started at on the campus of Oregon State University, which has come about because of some of his efforts, and also has generated a fair amount of media interest in my community. This was the front page of the Corvallis Gazette Times Mid-Valley Sunday, so Albany and Corvallis. So this is an issue that is of concern to people in my community, and I appreciate your willingness to hear it. And with that, I will leave it to you, Ken. Second,
well,
Ken.
Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask her a question.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. And then I was going to ask Sandy to actually tell us what the bill does.
Okay. No.
Okay. Would you just explain the bill? That probably we didn't get to that. So.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. House Bill 2699 requires the Department of Human Services to specify that blastocytosis is a reportable disease.
Thank you, Sandy. And thank Representative Greenlick, did you have a question?
Yes, I do, if
okay.
I may. Looking at the bill and ORS 433-004,
mm-hmm.
I was intrigued that in the first section of 433-004, it says that the Department of Human Services shall by rule specify reported diseases. Reportable diseases. And then this in the fourth section specifies a reportable disease. Are there any other reportable diseases specified by statute as opposed to letting the Department of Human Services do it by rule?
That is an issue that I learned about following introduction of the bill. It is my understanding that this typically is done by rule as opposed to by statute.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Gelser, for representing your constituents so well. Is it Baruch? Borrow. Mr. Borrow.
Well, Representative Kotek, thank you, and members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today.
And your name for the record, sir.
My name is Ken Borum. My address is 2685 Southwest Diarmond, Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm here representing the Blastocystis Research Foundation, which is a coalition of patients who've been diagnosed with this. I know it's late, so I don't think we'll take the whole half hour. There were two other people who were going to come up with me, but they weren't able to be here, so we videotaped their testimony. We've got it on the presentation here, too. So has anyone never heard of blastocystis before?
Yes.
Representative Gelder, one for a second. I had never heard of it before coming to Corvallis. I wish I never had. Let's just start out with Alex's testimony. Alex is a teacher in Corvallis. Male teacher, one of the very few there, and just let him speak for himself here.
So, yeah, well, just introduce yourself and tell us a little about your experience.
Okay, my name is Alexander. I'm 25 years old, and I was born and raised here in Corvallis. And I have had quite a tumultuous relationship with blastocystis the last about a year and a half of my life. I am I work at a middle school, at a public middle school, and so last year when I was at the worst of my sickness, it really affected my ability to kind of be an effective educator. Just the way blastocystis dysfunction itself, it brings on intense weight loss and fatigue, diarrhea, a host of symptoms that are not very enjoyable, and it kind of got progressively worse and worse, but definitely affected my ability to be effective in my job and to really be able to have the energy that I needed.
You know, what kind of symptoms do you have?
The symptoms that I've had started out as with diarrhea, serious rapid weight loss, inability to tolerate most types of foods, lots of abdominal discomfort, and pain and bloating, and those symptoms got progressively worse and worse, to the point where it was just, you know, I couldn't even go for a 15-minute walk without feeling extremely fatigued and tired, and not really being able to tolerate much food in the first place. It's really a big issue for a lot of people, and I think it affects the quality of their life and the quality of their ability to execute their jobs and just enjoy life in general. And I think that is a public health concern for everybody involved in their local community regionally and in the whole Northwest. And so I think
any energy funding that can be devoted towards finding, you know, new treatment methods, towards tracking it, and just in general gaining more education and more knowledge about this and being able to present that to the public is definitely an extremely valuable case.
Great.
So that's Alex's testimony. In your packet, you've got letters from two physicians in Corvallis who both support the bill. Also included a copy of the Gazette Times article. There's also a book. You can download the first four chapters from our website, and it's available on Amazon.com, which is called Commensal Blastocystis, Pathogenic Blastocystis with Case Studies from Oregon to the Willamette Valley. And this has, I've taken some of the case studies out of here, interviews with patients who've had this and have had similar experiences. My experience, I guess, was similar to that for the first year or two of my infection. I moved here in 2000, and within 3 years I had it. First year or two were kind of uneventful, and then symptoms got worse. You go to doctors and they just have never heard of it or just really don't know how to handle it. Kept losing weight. Then you start going on what I call medical tourism, which is driving around to different states in the country trying to find somebody who knows how to deal with this. And my two children have been diagnosed with it as well. Our medical costs just for me are around $10,000 with $15,000 in disability costs so far. So this is it's a very expensive disease. Primarily, I don't think it needs to be expensive, but primarily because it's not being addressed properly, it becomes expensive for patients. I thought when I came here I was going to start a high-tech company, so never expected to be doing this. I would have paid more attention to my biology class had I known I'd be doing this kind of work. So I'm the founder and director of Blastocyst Research Foundation. It's a nonprofit patient advocacy group. You can get more information about it from that website. I should have put that on our handout, but if anyone wants to jot it down there, there are links to the KVAL interview, the article that was in the Gazette Times as well, and you can also download the first couple chapters of our book there. So I used to think there were government organizations which handled things like this, and I really was surprised when I contacted, this is the person who chairs the organization at the national level who is responsible for infectious diseases. And I explained the problem we were having with blastocystis in Corvallis in Oregon. And it wasn't a question of, which is a little scary, it wasn't a question of we don't want to help, it's a question of they can't help. What happened in the 80s and 90s when AIDS became an emerging infectious disease is they took all the resources from protozoal research and moved it into viral research and AIDS research. So there are really no people left at the federal level who can address a protozoal infection like this. So our goals here, obviously we're talking about 2699. I also wanted to give you some background on this. There's an active OSU research program on this. You'll be reading about it in the newspaper. We're developing new diagnostic tests. We may find in the coming months or years that certain diseases which have been thought to be caused by other things are actually caused by this. And we're also working with a military infectious disease group. And they're actually head of the OSU group, even though there's only one guy there. He's very enthusiastic about that. So you may be getting some information from that as well. And the final thing is networking. You know, we always need help. If anyone wants to help out on this, physicians, I know some people here are physicians and nurses, fundraising, public relations, anything like that. So you probably know this already. Viruses, bacteria, protozoa can all make you sick. Blastocystis is the most prevalent GI infection in both the United States, and we don't have statistics in Oregon that are perfect, but just calling around at the hospitals, it's the most frequently diagnosed GI parasitic GI infection from Good Samaritan Hospital. And if there's an article in there that has national statistics on there. When they first found it, they thought it was harmless. And you know, the question is, if it was harmless, you know, I talked about it. And this was the first article that came out that started talking about people getting sick with it. Well, not the first, but this one really started the kind of a nasty debate. Usually research magazines like this are pretty subdued, but this sort of turned the whole thing into a big wrestling match. These guys from Saudi Arabia started writing in and talking about this disease that caused fatigue and depression and headaches, and you know, in the United States, this thing is considered commensal. You know, it's not considered to be something that causes disease. It was also a little bit unusual because, if you notice, diarrhea is only present in a quarter of the cases. And in the infections we're used to seeing in the United States, which are viral and bacterial, diarrhea is usually the main symptom. In this case, constipation is actually a more larger symptom. And that's true of other protozoal infections like Entamoeba histolytica. But you know, obviously, if somebody comes into a doctor here and says, I'm fatigued and have constipation, they're not going to run a stool test, you know, which is part of the problem. So what happened is when that got published, these folks from Oakland, California wrote back and said, you know, you guys aren't running your slides right, and you know, it's this thing cannot cause disease, and you know, there's never been an epidemic, there's never been a point source outbreak, so you know, you guys are crazy. So over the next 10 years, we got good chance to use my little pointer here. We got most of those things. The epidemics and the point source outbreaks occurred here. These articles are included in your handout. Epidemic of infections in school children. This was the original article from Saudi Arabia. Then we've got returning Gulf War veterans. Reports from Iran. Some good research coming out of Egypt. And right now in Pakistan, 30% of college-age students there have chronic abdominal pain. Coincidentally, 30% of the people coming back from the Gulf War had undiagnosed illness. So that's one reason we're working with the military infectious disease research group. And then it kind of got more interesting after that. In Italy, where most of these reports came out, looks like it hit there in mid-90s. And then the final report all the way up top here is from Australia. So what we saw was this disease started turning up in dermatology magazines, which is a little weird. Why would a GI infection turn up in dermatology magazines? And the reason we still don't know exactly what causes the rash, but you know, my theory is that this is an invasive organism. And these are a couple of shots of the rash. Kind of comes in two types. The one on top is this kind of diffuse pruritic rash, which people get, and it comes and goes. The one on the bottom is more of a prolonged area where you'll get, you know, certain lesions which don't heal and stay there for a long time. These are the symptoms of our research subjects in Corvallis. Pretty much just what we've said, abdominal pain, diarrhea, skin rash, and so on. About half of these people are public employees. So, you know, this is something that is costing the state. You know, something you definitely want to take. You know, people talk about the cost of tracking the infection, but, you know, if you consider that the state is the largest insurer, in the state of Oregon, that you know, the money you may be paying out in terms of endoscopies and unnecessary procedures to diagnose an infectious disease, I think you're going to be astounded once we start looking around and seeing where this is showing up. So the question is, how does a disease that's harmless in the U.S. cause problems in the Middle East? Now, how can the same organism cause two different sets of symptoms in two different places? And the answer is it can't. And it took 16 years to get this research out. This wasn't done until 2005. And the guys who are on this list are some of the world's leading eukaryotic researchers. Sogin is at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, Pasteur Institute. And what they did is they took 100 isolates from humans and birds and mammals, and they charted them all genetically. And they came up with this, which is kind of hard to read, so that's a little easier to read. And what they found out is there wasn't one. Before that, people thought there was just one thing called Blastocystis hominis that infected people. And then there were these other blastocystis that infected animals and birds. And what they found out is that's not true. It turns out human beings are picking up isolates from birds, animals, and rodents all the time. So their analysis showed a couple of avian isolates here, a couple that are associated with domesticated animals. And then this, which is the one we're really interested in now, which comes from rodents, and this, which seems to have teed off from that. And then you can kind of look over here, and you know, you probably don't want to be getting anything from a sea snake or a lizard, just as a matter of course. Unfortunately, when they did this, there's something about microbiologists that they don't ask what the symptoms were when they got the isolates. So the question is, what happens when you compare the isolates from people in the U.S. who were healthy, well, maybe not anymore, but and then people from who are not healthy from the Middle East? And this work got done last year, and wow, sure enough, when you cultured the isolates from the people who weren't healthy, they created this. This article is in your packet too. Unfortunately, Representative Kremel is gone. He seems to like a lot of evidence, so this would. So you know that I mean that just looks something like you don't want to have. it's big. It's highly adhesive. The isolates from all the people who were asymptomatic cultured to these vacular forms. These things look even more different under a microscope. You know, these things look totally harmless. They're like little beach balls that kind of bounce around and bounce off of each other. These things stick to everything. They stick to your cover slips. They stick to your slides. You can't wash them off. And then just for good measure, you see, before this, everybody who had blastocystis, when you went into the doctor thought there was something wrong with you. So they would run these endless array of tests to figure out what was wrong with you. What this showed is maybe it's not something. It's not the person. Maybe it's the organism. And just in case somebody might say, well, maybe there's something wrong with you that's making the amoeboid forms, they did a genetic analysis. And they found out, yeah, it's a different organism that's causing people to be sick. And this is what happens when you don't understand the difference between the one that makes you sick and the one that doesn't. You run endless testing. This is from a 25-year-old patient. I can't imagine he's lived long enough to have all these tests run. But it just goes on and on, and we're at the Mayo Clinic, and we got all this stuff going on here. So this is potentially a very expensive disease if you don't diagnose it and address it properly. So there'll be a quiz on this in a second. Major points, this is the most commonly diagnosed GI parasitic organ, and similar data you can pull from other states. Exposure to untreated water, well water, and rivers is a risk factor. That may be one reason why it's common in Oregon. Specific variants are probably responsible for the disease. We don't have clinical tools, but we're working on them at OSU and with another research group. And right now we're using diagnosis by exclusion to diagnose the infection. Any questions?
I have one. I'm assuming that, can you diagnose it primarily through stool samples? Is that how you would?
You can, about 50% of the cases will show up in a stool sample.
And that's not foolproof, but that would be the general.
Yeah. And, it was interesting. When I first got into this, I thought, well, the problem is we need to get a more sensitive test. So that's what I've been working on. But then when I got out there and started talking to people and realized that they're not even getting the 50%, probability by going to the doctor. You know, I've talked to people who've been on Prevacid for, a year or two, and they've had, diarrhea, and their doctor never sent them to get an O&P test. So that was a whole different which I never even considered.
Well, and the reason I asked that is, and thank you for clarifying that, is I knew someone who needed to have a stool test but did not have insurance. And it's not exactly easy to go get one done if you're not covered. Mm-hmm. It's been my impression. It costs a couple $100 to have to send it away. I mean, it's, so if you even wanted to do it yourself because you didn't have any kind of coverage, it's complicated.
Yeah, one interesting thing on that, we're working with one group that developed the it's a little test for Giardia, and you can go buy it and do it at home, and it's only for animals because the AMA doesn't, I guess, want people to use it. But it's the same organism, so if you wanted to use it for yourself, you could. And I think it would be great if a lot of these tests were available over the counter. You could just keep them at home and run the tests and then, get the results on the weekend and then bring the results to the doctor. Okay, here, promised a quiz. There's a large, well-funded, well-staffed agency with protozoal experts who keep on top of emerging diseases. That's false.
You wanted an answer.
Passport regulations will ensure protozoal diseases cannot enter the United States. Okay, obviously. I've shown some of these papers to people, and they say, well, that's in Italy, or that's in Saudi Arabia, or that's in, we've gotten as far as Denmark, where we have good research. So, we've actually genetically sequenced some of these, so we can show they're here. Only one variant infects humans, that's clearly false. And the last one is, this one I always was surprised about. I kind of thought that the doctors would form these organizations and address these things. And I think that's what a lot of people are expecting to happen. But they're sympathetic, but I get the feeling that they don't know exactly what to do. There's not a really clear, you know, 1, 2, 3. So one good reason to make this reportable is to give them some kind of structure within which they can operate to report these infections. Okay, why legislate? So this is what's reportable already. I've had a couple of these. They aren't that bad. Had months.
Excuse me, just to cover. These are what we report in Oregon.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's some others as well.
And this is established in rule right now. This is what we.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Had Giardia, and I'd like this prevention to be like Giardia. I'd like you to be able to go in, you get the test, you get a few pills, and it's non-event. You know, Giardia was a non-event for me, and that's just because they had a good medication, they had a decent test, and they had a good doctor who knew what he was doing. He ran the test, he said it came back negative. That means you have Giardia. You know, this was back in the 80s, and they didn't have the better tests for it, but he was savvy enough, and he kind of knew what he was doing, so he could diagnose it and deal with it. What we have with blastocystis is the exact opposite. We have poor diagnostics, and the treatments really are not working as well as they used to. Dog bites are down here, too. So I figure if you can report the dog bites, you can report something like this. What's happening here, about half the people we've talked to...
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Yes, Dr. Zachary.
Thank you.
And did you have a question?
Well, back at the backside, were any of those, none of those were, became reportable diseases by statute, right? They all became reportable diseases because the health division, or whatever it's called today, saw a need for it and created the reportable disease by rule.
That could be very possible, and I think in this case it may be necessary. And in fact, all of these, I mean, I wish I had gotten something on here because they know what these are. This is an emerging infectious disease, and it's coming at a time in our history where we've unfortunately destaffed a lot of our experts who address emerging infectious diseases.
May I follow up?
Yes.
Have you talked to the state epidemiologist and others who are responsible for that?
My wife has a story on that. We called her and we described him, and then she said, "My God, my kid's been throwing up every day for a year."
That's a him.
Was that
your local health?
It was a woman at the office, and I've got this.
And if you'd like to come up
arms.
And testify, that'd be great.
No, my question is, there are folks in the state health division that are responsible.
We've sent them copies of it, and they're aware of our organization, and if they would like to engage us more closely, we'd be happy to engage with them.
Let me try one more time.
Yes.
Have you specifically asked them to run this through their reportable disease process?
And just introduce yourself for the record.
Okay, my name is Tessa Hanover, and we've been dealing with this for 3 years. Recently, I finally called everyone I could call. I called everyone. I called all the health departments. I called Corvallis, Eugene, and Portland. I called the water departments. I asked, can you look for parasites? We drink two-thirds of our water in Corvallis out of the river. Salem just dumped their raw sewage in the river around the holidays. And I know this because it was in the paper. And it's like, I'm sitting there going, we're drinking out of that river. I know it flows north, but what's Eugene and Harrisburg? What's everybody doing? We get our water from that river. And I called all these health departments and all these, I called Portland, the state epidemiologist. I'm sorry I didn't write down her name. And she told me there's just no money to do this. And I got that over and over again. It's a non-issue.
Representative Gelser, would you like to comment since you've been working?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I mean, part of this, the issue of the reporting by rule and reporting on statute, I would like to take responsibility for that, and that my constituent contacted me, and I think that I probably, prior to introducing the bill, did not appropriately research what the history had been of how diseases have become reportable. So I feel like that's a question that probably I should have been able to answer for my constituent.
Let me ask you, did the state health department respond to this at all?
We're going to hear from the state health department in a little bit.
Oh,
I met with them earlier this week.
So maybe we could finish up your presentation or additional questions or any other comments, and then we'll tag team this. So.
Great.
We kind of moved ahead then.
So we have people coming in here, bringing this in. So these are the other patient testimonies. Common theme. This is a little girl. She's losing 10% of her body weight. another couple of people in Jefferson, Oregon, probably on well water right next to each other. Same kind of thing. They're having endoscopies the whole bit, and they don't really know what's going on. We need to address that, but you know, because of the diagnostics and treatments are so poor, we really need to be tracking it too to understand where it's coming from.
Do we know of any other states who track this?
I think Utah tracked it for a while. I've seen some data on it from them. I don't know if they're still tracking it. This was from Eugene. Same kind of story, uncontrolled weight loss, fatigue, and so on. This was really sad. This girl got it, this isn't her real name. She got it when she was 14, and she still has it. And this is someone who got it had it for all of her teen years, you know, which is really sad. And now she's going to university, and she can barely complete her classes because of this. A couple more. State of Oregon paid for this medical cost on this first one. Same kind of story, uncontrolled weight loss. She was never diagnosed, so we're really not sure what happened on her. Most of these are available on the website and in the book as well. Expensive testing. This came back from our Gazette Times article. This person got it in 1989, and they're still dealing with the issues. And it doesn't, when people don't have health care insurance, it goes beyond just how much the health care system is paying into this. So this family, I think we had put in our paper, we were trying to raise $50,000. They said they could have funded us twice over with what they've spent on this. So you're looking at a disease which can potentially, you know, bankrupt a family. So it is a serious thing. And then this just came out. You notice this one's in Turkey, again, the Middle East. So likely the Blastocystis hominis they're looking at is not Blastocystis hominis, but Blastocystis rattii, or one of the zoonotic transmissions. And they found out that this happened with Giardia too. Everybody can remember that far back, but Giardia used to be considered harmless. And then they found out it was harmful, and then they started doing statistics and found out that kids were actually smaller who had it, and they were scoring lower on their test scores, which got everybody really moving. So this is somebody at OSU said, gosh, this is just sounding like Giardia. And
my name is Leslie Jeffrey. I'm a special ed teacher at the Lowland School District, and I have a son who is 11, and he has blastocystis. I think he's had this parasite since he was 3 or 4 years old. His symptoms include abdominal pain and then this immediate, he has to get to the bathroom, and he has diarrhea. Because he's been exhibiting the same symptoms of excess mucus and stomach problems for many years. And this last fall, I was desperate. He has been suffering for so long that I thought we've got to figure out what to do. And he's taken lots of different medications. So my friend said, have you had him checked for a parasite? And I would never have thought of that. I went in to have him checked for allergies to gluten and dairy, and we checked for the parasite, and he had many blastocystises. So the doctor prescribed a round of antibiotics. He was tested again. He still had the parasite. So the pediatrician gave him another kind of antibiotic, saying that this is known to get rid of parasites, and the second round of antibiotic did not get rid of the blastocystis. So at this point, he still suffers.
Did his symptoms improve at all?
For about a week, he seemed his stomach wasn't hurting as bad, and the mucus subsided. But there tends to be this general sense of irritability, and he eats an enormous amount of food, but yet he's not gaining weight, which makes us think that the parasite is utilizing his food. We think that maybe he could have got this parasite from the local Willamette River, or we have a creek by our house in Philomath, and he's a very oral kid, and maybe, you know, he just picked it up from the local water. We do have a well that's 270 feet deep, but there's five people that drink from it, and he's the only person that has had complaints or stomach problems. I think it's important for the health department to record and have this database so we can have statistical data to show that there are a lot of people and kids that suffer from the blastocystis.
So just in response to the budget questions, Oregon used to be a real leader in health research. This is from 1986. We used to go out and look for infections like this and screen people in daycare. We found E. coli. Does everybody know that? Right here. This was the first article ever published on pathogenic E. coli. Similar kind of thing. Everybody has E. coli. It's everywhere. Who would ever believe it's a pathogen? Same with blastocystis. A few parallels there. This is what's happening now. This is what's going to public health. And, you know, I understand all these are needed for people who are disadvantaged and, you know, but if you can't keep your working population healthy, you're not going to have the money to pay for everybody else. So, you know, maybe this, you know, people keep telling me they can't do anything because there's no money. Maybe that piece of the pie needs to get a little larger. If you don't, I think we're going to have a really, really big medical industry in Oregon and not much else.
Ken, before I lose too many more committee members, we might want to wrap up so we can hear from public health. But
sure. This is from Tom Eversole. Oregon spends less than 60 cents a person, about the amount of a candy bar. I think we need to fix that. This was a quote from Dr. Terrence Hill, a board-certified gastroenterologist in Corvallis, which absolutely blew me away. Now, I'll let you read it, and it is absolutely amazing that something like this could exist and not be followed up on. I mean, inflammatory bowel disease, if that's a risk factor, or if even we've got cases where we're misdiagnosing an infection as inflammatory bowel disease, which does happen, then, wow, these people who could potentially be cured with antibiotic treatment, the proper antibiotic treatment. So those are the reasons, and if you want to help in other ways, too, we're trying to raise some money for the OSU program, a few other ideas. That's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you. That's why I love this job. I get to learn new things every day. Very, very helpful, and thank you for the reading packets. Questions? So I think we should probably hear from the folks from the health division. And is it Mr. DeBess?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How are you? Good to see you.
Introduce yourself. And
all right. Good afternoon, Chair Kotek. My name is Emilio DeBess. I'm the state public health veterinarian, and I'm here for Dr. Cohn, who was unable to come in to testify in regards to blastocystosis. The State Department of Health is in opposition to House Bill 2699, which would make blastocystosis a reportable condition in Oregon. Just so you can have a little bit of history, and I believe that the individual before me talked about blastocystosis was discovered in 1911, and since then hasn't had much influence or interest until the 1960s and 70s, in which it actually became a parasite. Since then, more interest was given to blastocystosis when AIDS and HIV became a prevalent condition and disease. And at that point, more information came out in regards to blastocystosis. Until the 1990s, in which multiple papers and a number of different individuals, scientists within the community, decided that fight it back and forth in regards to whether it's a true pathogen or not. It is important to know that people get diagnosed with blastocystosis when they have their stool checked because they're not feeling well or have diarrhea. We believe, and so does the Centers for Disease Control, that blastocystosis is actually within a number of organisms that actually do not cause disease in all individuals in the population. And in fact, just because you have the organism present in the stool does not necessarily mean that that's the cause of the problem. In reality, when you look at stool, as it stated before, a lot of laboratories actually look at blastocystis or find blastocystis, as well as finding a number of other pathogens may not necessarily create or cause disease. There are few lines of evidence in regards to blastocystosis, but one of them, the latest article in the year 2000, has to do with a Swedish study in which they actually looked at people that were sick and people that were well, and they actually found more blastocystosis in well people than they did in sick people. And that's kind of a landmark article. They have actually been able to determine that sometimes blastocystosis is related to organisms like Entamoeba histoerica, another parasite that actually can cause disease. And when the individuals are treated that only have blastocystosis, the likelihood of resolving the actual infection has been erratic, meaning some individual resolve, some individual don't do well, and some individual do extremely well. So it's very variable in regards to what happens when a person is treated. As I said before, the AIDS and HIV era did not put blastocystis forward as an organism that could actually cause illness in people that were immune compromised. One of the interesting facts about this particular pathogen or organism or parasite is that when it was actually fed to animals that were bacteria-free, it did not cause a disease. And that's one of the bases by which we actually look at how a bacteria or parasite works. Based on the number of studies that we have seen and have read, about 10 to 20% of the population throughout the world and some in the United States may actually carry blastocystis. That would equal to about 700,000 individuals in Oregon carrying the organism, walking around with blastocystis and not having any symptoms at all. So that's very telling of the likelihood of the organism and the possibility of causing disease. We did ask outside of Oregon as to how people felt about blastocystis, and we surveyed 30 states out of the 50 states, and none of them make blastocystis a reportable condition. We asked the CDC, they have a parasitology or a parasite epidemiology section in which they deal with things like Giardia and other parasites. And again, they quote-unquote claim that there's no convincing evidence at this point that would make us think that blastocystis is actually an organism that could actually cause an illness or disease. In regards to the number of organisms, the number of people that could actually be walking around with this particular organism, it seems like it would be create an additional amount of work, not only for the laboratories, but the physicians, health departments, et cetera. We agree that this is an organism that needs more research, that we need to find out more as to what's going on with blastocystis and the breadth of disease that it could actually cause or may not cause. And as we see it so far, it's not panning out to be a disease-causing organism. We do, again, support the idea of research, but by making it a reportable condition, it won't actually fulfill the need to create the research that it's necessary to help people that may have the organism. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Sure. I do have a number of documents that there's one particular document that it's a fairly large document, so I can make a copy for you to read.
Representative Gelson.
I do have a question. Thank you so much for your testimony. Have you heard before, have there been discussions in the circles of infectious disease people or parasitic disease people about this question of individuals bringing this back from travel to the Middle East or troops coming back? And I'm also wondering if you could comment on, for my community, I'm from the community that Mr. Borum is from, what might explain that seeming prevalence that is confirmed by doctors in our community and certainly the experience of many of my constituents in terms of being sick and being told by their physicians that it's the blastocystosis that's causing that for them.
Yeah. Chair Kotek, representative. I was asked to do a research, a scientific research on the matter, and I have seen some reports in which they actually claim that people that do travel overseas come back to the United States, some symptomatic, some not, with the organism. So it is one of the conditions or one of the factors that people think that may be significant is that travel overseas that may actually lead to finding the organism. And when you look at the papers reported from the papers that are written or published, a lot of them are from overseas places like Saudi Arabia, Slovenia, Nepal. All those places report a large number of cases of both symptomatic and asymptomatic infection with blastocystis. I forgot your second question.
The second question was about the seeming prevalence in the community that I represent, where we have numbers of people who are quite ill, whose physicians are telling them that this is the cause of their illness. Is my community unique in the state of Oregon for that, and is something like that of concern, and might there be another avenue beyond a bill to pursue finding out how to treat what seems to be a public health issue in the district that I represent?
Yeah, as stated before, blastocystis is not a reportable disease. So we usually don't hear about infections, but we do hear about outbreaks of disease, meaning multiple people in one community. We hear about that, and we usually hear about it from physicians or nurses or anybody, mm-hmm. laboratories that will tell us, we have a huge number of people in one area affected with this particular illness. And it's not limited to the list of diseases that you actually saw up there. We actually go out and investigate a lot more, MRSA or MRSA in wrestlers. I mean, we do a fair amount of work trying to find out more as to how diseases and different conditions affect the population. The fact that we haven't heard from physicians, nurses, or laboratories perhaps is indicative of the level of concern that physicians may have in that respect. I have seen some data in regards to blastocystis reported by laboratories, but I also have seen not only blastocystis, but a number of other parasites that could also be pathogenic and create the same conditions. So scientifically, we have to be careful about what we blame for the particular illness and try to assess what is truly the cause of the problem, which is truly, and again, I say that again, is it's truly a research project and it's not a factor of surveillance.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Dr. DeBess. Any questions, further questions? I really appreciate your testimony. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
The extra work you did on this. And I want to thank Ken and Tessa for coming. And I'm not a scientist, but I thought some of that was pretty compelling. And at minimum, perhaps we can set up an appointment with Dr. Cohn.
Yes.
To look over the materials and sit down and talk about it. It's kind of like the chicken or the egg. We don't know there's a problem because we're not tracking it, but if we don't track it, we don't know there's a problem. So, if we could have some other discussion. I understand the issue around not putting, what we want to, report on in statute.
Sure.
I understand that. Right. I understand the rule issue there. But, if we could have some further discussion internally with the department, we'd really appreciate that. At least I would.
Chair Kotek, as stated before, a lot of the samples that we usually hear about it and see in our reports may not only have blastocystis but may have other parasites as well, which is why we scientifically need to look at this. And perhaps the Health Division is not the right body to do this, but the research community in regards to what could actually be creating the problem. But Dr. Cohn would be more than happy to discuss that with you all.
That would be great. I appreciate that. Representative Gelson.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for coming and the efforts that you put into this. And Dr. Cohn came and talked with me earlier this week, and I appreciated that. And to Ken and Tessa, thank you so much for coming up and giving your presentation. You continue to be very impressive, and I think it means a lot when there are issues that face our families, and I think there's nothing that can make us more passionate than trying to keep our families healthy and safe. And thank you, Representative Kotek, for hearing this bill, and colleagues for hearing it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. And it's nice to have your kids here, too, so thank you for bringing them. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2699 and open a public hearing, and open a work session on House Bill 2593. And I want to thank the committee for their ability to stick with us here. We've had a very busy afternoon. Sandy, you want to remind us what 2593 is, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, House Bill 2593, as you'll recall, had a public hearing on February 20th that is back before us today for a work session. This bill allows individuals that have retired from the Public Employees Retirement System, otherwise known as PERS, to re-enter the workforce full-time by a public employer if they are a nurse or a nurse instructor without losing their PERS retirement benefits. This and the action today is to move the bill to the full committee, if I understand correctly, Madam Chair.
That is. That's the intent. If committee so desires, we'll move it up to the full schedule for tomorrow in the full healthcare committee. And we had an extensive conversation about this, so do I hear a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move House Bill 2593 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Representative Gelser has moved House Bill 2593 with a due pass recommendation to the full House Committee on Healthcare discussion. I want to make sure that if there's some points we want to make sure we bring up in the full committee, if we've had all our questions answered. We had a pretty extensive discussion. Representative Flores, anything that...
No, I think I've had my questions addressed, but thank you.
Good. I want to, and I'll check in with Representative Brin since he had to leave early before tomorrow's full meeting. Any other comments, discussion about the bill? Seeing none, Aaron, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Delson. Aye. Vice Chair Barnegie. Excused. Vice Chair Broom. Excused.
Chair Kotek.
Aye. Motion carries, and need a carrier for the poll.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have any volunteers?
Madam Chair, by default, I think Representative Gelser will be it since I won't be with you tomorrow.
And I am happy to do that, although I was ill, so was not here for the conversation.
I'll do it.
Chair Kotek.
Thank you. I'll do it. No problem. All right. Close the work session on House Bill 2593. Missing anything else? Nope. Then I will close the committee meeting and we'll...